Friends, our second scripture comes from the Gospel of John, the 10th chapter. Listen for the word of the Lord as it speaks to you this morning, wherever it is that you find yourself. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand, who is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and runs away. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. The hired hand runs away because a hired hand does not care for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life in order to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. I have received this command from my Father. Friends, this is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Just this last week, we were having family dinner, as we often do, and Laura asked Joanna to recall the story that she had learned at the First Pres Day School that morning. So Joanna says, "Mommy, Daddy, it was the story of when Jesus saw a man who could not see. And then Jesus spit on the ground and put the mud in the blind man's eyes." I thought, that is very specific. And I said, "Joey, why do you think Jesus did something like that?" She said, "Because Jesus wanted him to see." Jesus wanted him to see. Little did I know that that story about Jesus spitting into the mud and healing a blind man would feature so heavily in what I would talk to you about this week. In fact, it's just the story that happens right before Jesus says this very odd thing, "I am the good shepherd." Let me fill the story out for you a little bit more. It was during the Feast of Tabernacles, which is one of the high holy feast days of the Jewish people. Think of it as something like a Thanksgiving, where everyone is eating, everyone's in the city, everyone's enjoying time together, the crowds are huge, and amidst the throng of people, Jesus is walking with his disciples, and he notices there a blind man. Now, this isn't just any blind man, this is the blind man who was born blind. And Jesus is drawn to him, as Jesus is often drawn to lost sheep. And he reaches down into the mud and he spits. I want you to picture how odd this would look for a famous teacher to be doing. Spits in the mud and he grabs the spittle and the mud and he smears it on the man's eyes for everyone to see. And then he invites the man to go and wash in a place called the Pool of Siloam, which was a well-known pool. And the blind man, who's not named, emerges, and he sees, for the first time, sees the faces of family and friends, loved ones, sees the beauty of the Jerusalem temple, sees the face of Jesus. Perhaps Jesus' face was the first face that he saw. He moves from darkness and into light, which is one of the Gospel of John's favorite images of moving from darkness into the light. Jesus wanted him to see. And of course, the reaction of the crowds is that they are elated, right? They throw a celebration. They surround the man with embrace. They tell of the good news that Jesus has healed the blind man who once was blind and now can see. All right? Well, actually, that's not what happens. The exact opposite happens. The people interrogate the blind man. "Who was it that touched you?" They just can't believe that something like this could possibly happen in their midst, which I think is something we can identify with. The blind man says, "I don't know, just that guy Jesus. He touched me and now I can see." Well, that wasn't satisfying for the people, so they call in the big guns, the heavy hitters, the Pharisees. Say Pharisee. When you hear the word Pharisee, I want you to think of Bible teacher, Bible professor, pastor types. They were faithful leaders of the Jews who were learned and were trying to call the people of God into more expansive way of living that had to do with following the commands that God had lovingly given them. They often enter into arguments with Jesus, and some of them Jesus rebukes. But these were good people, and as we'll come to see, I think we're more like the Pharisees than we are Jesus most of the time. The Pharisees are even more upset with the situation than are the crowds. They want to know who has touched this man. And once they find out it was Jesus, they throw the blind man out of their midst. The implication is that they drive him out of the religious community, out of the festival. So if imagine for a moment with me that somebody who was born with a genetic disease of some kind, or blindness, or deafness, or something, comes to First Presbyterian and is magically healed, and me and Pastor Lar and Pastor Randy get together and not only question this person and litigate, but we end up deciding we're going to kick him to the curb and throw him out of the religious establishment. That's sort of the picture of what's going on here. So why are the Pharisees so non-inclusive? What are they upset about? Well, they're upset about two things. The first thing is that only God can heal. So if you tell me that this human being, rabble-rouser teacher from the backwoods place of Nazareth has put his hand on you and healed him, well, that can't be true because only God can open the eyes of the blind. That's number one. Number two is when Jesus heals. Now, this is really important. Jesus heals this blind man on the Sabbath, which within Judaism is not Sunday, is Saturday. Now, Judaism back then, as is for Judaism today, practices Sabbath and holds it in the highest regard. And one of the conversations within Judaism is how you define what is the work that you're not allowed to do on the Sabbath. And this conversation still exists within Judaism. As an example, I've been to hotels in the land of Israel where on the Sabbath day, the elevators are programmed to go up every single floor and come down every single floor. So if you're on floor 14, you're going to have to wait 1 through 14 or take the stairs because it is considered work by some Orthodox Jews to touch the button in order to move the elevator. So on the Sabbath, the elevators move for you. They've also got kosher cell phones so that you can connect to family without having to press a button, right? Thank goodness for Siri. You can FaceTime your family on the Sabbath. And in Jesus' day, the Sabbath was held in the highest regard and esteem. And the Pharisees could not believe that a religious teacher who's supposed to know better would possibly have the gall to touch a man and heal on that sacred day, that most sacred of days. So I want you to have that story rolling around in you as we continue to talk about the Good Shepherd, because it's in that context with the Pharisees sitting there, maybe even the blind man there, the disciples and the crowd, and as Jesus enters into a dialogue with the Pharisees. And he does dialogue a little differently than we do. He doesn't spew hatred and venom at them. Instead, he offers some odd image that people have to contemplate. In this instance, he says, "I am the Good Shepherd." Now, this is a part of the so-called I am sayings in John. Jesus offers these statements that are supposed to sort of lift the veil back and show you a little bit deeper image of who Jesus is, what he's really like. I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the door. Anyone who knocks will receive me. And here, I am the Good Shepherd. I want to break that phrase apart a little bit to explain to you further what's going on. Those first two words, I am, you got to jump in a DeLorean for those Back to the Future fans, and you got to go all the way back to the book of Exodus, where Moses, a lonely shepherd who has fled Egypt because he's murdered a guy, he's consigned himself to spending the rest of his life as a shepherd, and God meets him, do you remember where? In a burning bush. In a burning bush, and God says, Moses, I'm going to send you to my people Israel to liberate them. And he says, okay, that sounds like a terrible idea, but even if I say yes, when the people ask me who sent me, what am I supposed to say? Who sent me? In other words, Moses says, God, what's your name? Who really are you? Now, this is interesting, and I wonder if you've thought about this before. I've talked with my youth about this, but did you know that God is not God's name? God is not God's name. God is a title, right? Like, my name isn't Pastor. My name is Josh. Pastor is my title. God is a title. It's a good one. It's who God is. But God doesn't respond and say, well, I'm God, Moses. He says, I am that I am. Which I'm sure Moses was like, that sounds pretty abstract to me. But the idea behind it, God is the being one. God's name comes from the verb to be. It means that God is activity, is action, is moving, is alive, is dynamic power. And just when you try to confine the being one into a cage, he's already going to have moved beyond your conception of him, because he is the being one. I am that I am, or some translate it, I will be that I will be. So not only has Jesus healed a man with spit and mud, and not only has he healed a man on the Sabbath, it's two strikes. Here's the third strike. He says the phrase, I am. Now, that one would have really gotten the Pharisees upset, because they would have wondered, is this guy saying that he identifies with, is similar to the Great One? The one who said to Moses, I am that I am? The second thing that happens in that saying is the Good Shepherd piece. Now, I hope that you see that the eternal I am and the role shepherd are two things that are odd to put together. So let's talk about shepherd a little bit. This is where our 21st century ears and eyes can sometimes fail us. In the first century and in the biblical tradition, shepherds were everywhere, right? King David, you know King David, when he was chosen to become king, he wasn't even there, right? He was out in the fields with the flock. Moses, great shepherd. The prophet Amos, a shepherd. Every single Christmas, we remember a group of lowly shepherds who bore witness to the coming of Jesus into the world. Shepherds in the first century were not adults, most likely. This wasn't necessarily a chosen career. They were probably teenagers. And if you go to the Middle East today, you will see plenty of shepherds who are teenage boys and girls leading the flock. Shepherding in the first century was not considered a great profession, right? It didn't make you a part of the urban elite. You weren't a part of the rich and famous. Right? You probably didn't have a lot of followers on Twitter or likes on Instagram. You were a few steps below the rung of blue-collar worker. And that is because being a shepherd was a dirty and dangerous job. I said a little bit about that in the children's message, but if you were a shepherd, you could be out for days and weeks overnight camping out with the sheep just to find them the right pasture and the right land and the right water sources to drink from, which is fine during the spring when the rains have come. But during the summer, when the rains dry up, Israel can be an arid place, especially in the wilderness regions where you can look around for miles and see barely a tuft of grass, which is where some of these shepherds would lead their sheep, because they knew where the little bits of vegetation were and they knew where the little rivers were. It was dangerous because sheep's wool and skin were really of high value. Wool was used in trade in a variety of things. The sheep's skin was used to create skins for water, so the veritable first century water bottle, sheepskins. So that meant that robbers would try to come and snatch your sheep. So the shepherds had to deal with robbers who would come stalking in the night. But they didn't just have to deal with human predators. They had to deal with animal predators as well. Wolves, mountain lions, which are predators that still exist in the hill country of Israel and Turkey to this day. At some point, a shepherd might have to put themselves between a wolf and the flock. You can imagine a 14 or 15-year-old with a big shepherd's staff. You know, you don't have a gun. You've got your staff, and that's all you've got. Maybe some stones. Maybe a sling like David and Goliath, and that's all. That's what it meant to be a shepherd in the first century. They were fighters. And in this instance, Jesus, sort of a fighter with the Pharisees. We like to imagine Jesus often as a meek and quiet, sort of meditative wisdom speaker, and he was those things, but there's a rough edge to Jesus too. When you mess with Jesus' sheep, he gets upset. He doesn't like it very much. So why is it that he's so upset with these Pharisees? Well, this reminds me of a story. A few years ago, we held our annual TWAM soup supper in this room. If you're not familiar, it's a tradition that goes way back where we cook some soup and gather together the Sunday before Thanksgiving. The young people who are going on our mission trip help serve the soup. And it's one of our great fundraisers. It's a great chance for our family, church family, to come together before the holiday. And this was a great night. Everything was going really, really well. The funds were coming in. The kids were happy. You were happy. The only couple things that weren't going well was that, number one, nobody was eating on my sweet potato chili, which, like, come on, guys. I know it's not real chili to some people, but next year, try it. And number two is that the Cheerwine chili, which is apparently the best chili of the batch, was for the fourth year in a row gone by the time I got to it. So whoever it is who makes the Cheerwine chili, if you could just make like 10 of those next year, that would be great. On that evening, I introduced a new tradition. I asked that people go around the room with a microphone and share what it is that they're thankful for. Something that I grew up doing around the Thanksgiving table in my home in Michigan, and I wanted to bring a little bit of that here. That was really meaningful. People were saying wonderful things until, that is, a homeless man walked up and grabbed the microphone from me. Now, I'd love to say in that moment that I exercised my better pastoral angels and was so excited to hear what this man had to say because he was a part of us, but that was not my reaction. All of the stereotypes about homeless people just running amok in my brain. What is he going to do? What is he going to say? How is it going to make me look? The church's event, right? What's going to happen? This beautiful night is going to be ruined. And he grabs the mic, and with tears in his eyes, he says, "I just want to thank you for letting me be a part of your family meal. The beautiful faces of your congregation and of your young people makes me remember that it is truly a gift to be alive." Wow, right? You ever have those moments where after you think something or say something, you sort of feel God shutting a door on your face, like, come on, what were you thinking? I was so fixated on everything being neat and in order. I was so fixated on what you all thought of the food and the event. I was so fixated on the exteriors of the religious observance of the evening that I almost missed a miracle right before my very eyes. This is the thing that makes Jesus the most upset often in the Gospels. It's when people consider the letter of the law, the traditions, the religious observance, and all that comes with it more important than the spirit of the law, which is that of liberation and healing. And God, the being one, working in our midst. It's really easy to think that Christianity, this whole thing we're a part of, is all about knowing and memorizing religious data, doing the right things, coming to church just enough so at the end, God pulls out his big checklist and says, well, you missed a few Sunday schools to go to the beach, but we'll let you pass with that. You're good. Well done, good and faithful servant. Right. But my guess is if I went around the room and asked why you're really here, it would be one of two answers. It would be either at some point in your life you saw something. You saw God, felt God, touched God, or you haven't seen anything yet, but you're really hoping to. You'd really like to see some healing. You'd really like to see the light. You'd really like to be moved from darkness into light. Because this man, though he was physically blind his whole life, the Pharisees who stand before him, they are spiritually and profoundly blind. They're missing the miracle of the healing right in front of them. The irony, right, is the very one, the Word, who gave them the very commands that they so earnestly want to follow, is standing in their midst, in the flesh, offering them life. And because they're so obsessed with the right way to do things, they completely miss it. It's in the context of that moment that Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. Pastor Laura read for you some words from the prophet Ezekiel. These words come from a moment in Israel's history where life was turbulent. The people of Israel didn't know which way was up or down or right or left, didn't know which voice of truth to follow. There was division and polarization and scattering everywhere. The northern and southern kingdoms of Israel had actually split like two parties, if that sounds familiar. People were alone, scared. They felt as if they could no longer hear the voice of God or see God working in the world. And the prophet Ezekiel notices in this time that there are arising false shepherds. And he says, false shepherds are those who feed themselves instead of feeding sheep. Instead of giving life to the sheep, they only give life to themselves. And they don't seek out the lost. These false shepherds, they're all about themselves, but they don't look for the least and the last and the lonely of the flock among them. They've forgotten them. It's a parable about the voices that we listen to in life. And I don't know about you and what your life is like, but in my life, there's certainly a lot of false shepherds around. And I'm not just talking about individual people. I'm talking about the cultural messages that we receive and devour and imbibe as people. I'm talking about this very American idea that everything has to be bigger and better and more productive. We need to be more successful. We need to prove everybody wrong. We need to have the most amount of money in the bank account. And the amount of money that we have now, if we just had an extra 7K, everything would be fine. We're not raising our children quite right. We need to raise them this way or that way. It's a false message that everything in life is about us. Feed yourself. Be concerned with yourself. It's all about you as an individual. Who cares who you leave in your wake as long as you get to the top where you want to go? The problem is, maybe you've gotten to the top, and if you have, you realize that it's pretty lonely up there because nobody else can really make it. If you're one of the lucky ones, you look around and you see that you've left everybody that really matters and everything that matters behind. The other false shepherd that I have in my life, I don't know if you have one of these, is what psychologists call the inner critic. It's the false shepherd that lives inside my head that not every once in a while, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 times an hour, chimes on in and says, hey, Josh, I don't know if you're really doing good enough. Shouldn't your church be a mega church by now? I think you could do better than you are. I think you could be more perfect than you are. I think you could put on another one of those masks that you've used to wearing so that everybody is pleased and happy with who you are. Because if you show them the real you, they're going to turn around and they're going to run as fast and as far as they possibly can. Any of you got an inner critic in there somewhere? Underneath all of that is the message that we're not really worthy of love and that we're not good enough. And Jesus looks at these false shepherds that are alive and well in our midst, and he says, I am the good shepherd. The difference between Jesus and the false shepherds is that he's good. Jesus doesn't feed himself, he feeds the world with the bread of life, with the blood of his body, feeds the multitudes in the wilderness who are like sheep without a shepherd. The Gospel of Luke tells us that when there are 100 sheep gathered together in a flock and one of the sheep finds his way out of the 100, Jesus leaves the 99 to go find the one. And when he finds the one, he throws that sheep onto his back and carries him home. Wouldn't you rather be led by that shepherd? So that's the shepherd, but then, okay, what about the sheep? What about us sheep? Well, sheep are kind of stupid, just to let you know. They can very easily veer away from the flock, find themselves alone. And the really, really bad things happen to sheep when they're alone. That's when the predators come to stalk. That's when the robbers come in to take them away. But sheep have one redeeming quality that's really, really important. Makes them one of the best creatures in the world. And that is that they know the shepherd's voice. They know the shepherd's voice unlike anything you can imagine. And that word know, when we hear the word know, we immediately, because we're brought up in the intellectual heritage of the West, we think about intellect and brains and trivia and school. But the word know in the Bible is so much more layered and rich. It's like the way that a mother knows their child's cry amidst 20 other cries. Right? It's like the way a child knows they are safe to run into their father's arms. It's the same word that's used to describe the physical intimacy between a husband and wife, to know one another. The sheep, Jesus says, know my voice. You can put a sheep who has been with one flock and one shepherd into a new flock with a new shepherd, and it will take them weeks, months, to know the voice of the new shepherd, because they are so honed in on the voice of their shepherd. So the question becomes, which shepherd are we listening to? And how do we come to know Jesus' voice if he's the shepherd we want to follow? I want to give you a few practical suggestions. I'm not going to leave you hanging because it's not easy. The first way I think that we can know Jesus' voice is simply to dive into the stories of the Gospels. Now, I'm not trying to give you yet another thing that you have to do in order to be perfect, so don't let your inner critic steer your reading of the Gospels and leave church and say, Pastor Josh said I must read the Gospels to be a good Christian. No, I'm inviting you to a source of life, because I know, I've drawn from those waters, I know that there's life there. Start with the Gospel of Mark. Read it with a friend or a spouse. Read a few verses at a time or a chapter a day. Get to know the sound of Jesus' voice. Number two, probably the most difficult one, I dare you to turn toward your inner critic, your false shepherd, and to begin to go about the long and difficult work of having compassion on yourself. It's often those inner voices that make us most vulnerable to lies. And it's often those inner voices, psychologists remind us, that come from our childhoods, where if maybe you've had this happen, something can happen to you or someone can say something, and in that moment, all of a sudden, you're 11 years old again. The hair stands up on your arms, your face goes red, your chest tightens, and you're 11 again. I dare you to face your inner critic. And Jesus promises to be with us in our wounds, right? Isn't he the one who picked up the mud from the ground and used the mud and the spit for healing? So certainly he can deal with the weird and muddy parts of our lives. And third and last, and maybe most important, I would invite you to dive into being a part of the flock. Dive into community. Dive into service. Jesus says several times in this passage that he lays down his life for the sheep. That's what makes him the good shepherd, is a life of self-sacrifice for others. And there are a lot of studies and data coming out about the difficulties that we face in this world, particularly our youngest people, and all of their outcomes are so heavily increased when they are a part of thick religious communities where they are reminded that they are loved no matter what. And if you, as a sheep, have found this flock to be meaningful, if you've met God here, then I also dare and invite you to invite another sheep who is lost here. Because Jesus says there are sheep that are not in the fold yet that I want to be here. So a part of our job is not just to appreciate the voice of the shepherd, it's to call other sheep in to the flock. I don't know about you all, but I'm sick of the sound of my own voice trying to save myself. I'm sick of the voice of the false shepherds leading me astray. I long to follow a voice that is more beautiful and good, the voice of the good shepherd, because he wants me to see, because the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thou rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.